Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Breakers, a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. My name is Tanner, and I'll be joined, as usual, by Taylor today. But before we get to that, we do have a new patron to thank. We want to say thank you to Andy. We hope you enjoy the stuff that's over on Patreon already. And we do have some great stuff coming up in the bonus sector in the very near future. Yeah, so let's just bring in Taylor here. Taylor, how's it going?
Pretty good. Pretty good. It's a Monday. It's a holiday. It's nice. It's nice being off work for Memorial Day and getting a chance to do this.
Yeah, just I've kind of forgotten that it's actually a Monday today.
Yeah, I know. It's nice. It feels like a bonus Sunday.
It's weirdest on like Twitter. I'll be doing my normal Twitter stuff and wondering like where are all of my friends from other places and realizing that other people are having normal days around the world.
Right, right.
What have you been up to in the past week?
Well, as far as media stuff goes, I guess the big one is we saw The Little Mermaid last night. It was actually really good. I wasn't cool. Quite sure what to expect.
Maritime related?
Yeah, it felt pertinent to the podcast. So it's definitely okay to use the podcast credit card for that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was good. I don't have any like special memories of the old animated one particularly, so I didn't have a lot to compare it to. Like, I know like we definitely watched it, but I don't think it was one.
It's not one that we had, so I don't think we watched that often.
I thought it was really good. The CGI was pretty good, and like the shipwreck scenes and stuff like that. I thought it was pretty fun to see. My only critique was that they like didn't really world build like the mermaid world at all, and that's a little disappointing. But yeah, it's good. It's definitely worth going to see.
You mean to tell me that this magical creature was not portrayed by a white woman? Let's see. For me, I finished, kind of started and finished The Indifferent Stars Above. I read it really fast.
Yeah, that's how I was. I couldn't put that one down.
I think I read it in like 4 or 5 different, you know, reading sessions. It was good. It was informative. I liked the structure of it in kind of focusing on Sarah Graves and how that related to the other members of it. And I think, you know, that's a story that I've heard in long form via podcasts. Like I know American Hauntings covered it, and Casting Lots, they also covered it as well. So I've heard it described in detail.
American Haunting is actually what got me to buy that book, Indifferent Stars Above. After I listened to it, I was like, I need to know more.
But I think reading it actually in printed book form, it did convey the length of time involved with all of this. Whereas you sit and you listen to like an hour podcast on it, everything's kind of condensed. But I think in that longer book form, it really did convey the fact that, you know, this was something happening over a span of months.
Also, and how like they had problems well before they ever got stuck. It's interesting to hear about the first part of that journey that we don't typically talk about.
Even the fact that, you know, they left like 3 weeks later than was advised. It's like from the beginning, they're kind of behind the eight ball. Yeah, it was very well done, very well written. And aside from that, I've been catching up on the Loremen podcast.
Nice.
It's probably my favorite overall podcast. It's just got everything. It's very informative. You know, if you like folk tales and folklore, ghosts and that type of thing. Very informative. A lot of fun stories that never come across elsewhere. It's probably the funniest podcast around. I mean, it's literally like joke after joke. It's pretty relentless, and it's one that builds on itself. So, you know, if you listen to it from the beginning, there's a lot of callbacks and inside jokes, and you feel like you're part of the family a little bit.
Cool. I have not listened to that too much.
It's so good. I recommend it for literally everyone should listen to the Loremen. And that's when I kind of let build up a little bit, you know, in chunks of 3 or 4, so I can listen to a lot of them back to back. That's been my entertainment recently.
Cool.
Before we get into things here, I did just want to say something about this. We mentioned last week, I think, from my media check-in, I mentioned the President Sees of the United States podcast. And I just want to say thank you to Jerry from that podcast for letting me read an intro quote for the most recent episode, When It Rains. I get to read a quote from Andrew Jackson.
Boo.
Boo, Andrew Jackson. He also gave us a very nice little shout out / review at the beginning of that episode. So if you happen to be joining us via Presidency's podcast, welcome. And we hope we live up to all of the hype. Yeah. So here we go.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's talk about a shipwreck.
I'd mentioned this before, but it was very strange this week sitting down and doing a more finite close-end story rather than the Armada that, you know, I've been working on for the past like 2 months.
But you got to continue to use your Spanish language skills.
Well, right. It's sort of like I'm kind of weaning myself off of that. another thing I'm reading right now is the next in the Diego Alatriste novels, which centers around kind of the same time period, a little bit later than the Armada. So nice. I'm slowly backing away from that topic. and yeah, for this one, a lot of the sources were available only in Spanish. Not a lot written in English about this vessel. And so this week, we are going back to somewhere that I've known we needed to return for about 2 years.
It's been a long time.
We're going back to the nation of Chile. Last time we were here was way back in episode 14.
That feels like the ancient times.
That was May of 2021, when we covered the Chilean military transport vessel SS Angamos. Definitely recommend going back and checking that one out if you haven't heard it.
Especially if you actually like us now and can ignore the probably right. lacking quality that it exactly. does contain.
Also, that was like 2 years ago. So if you have listened to it, maybe you need a review. There's elements of the show's production and presentation that we've polished up since then, but those early episodes are still solid stories.
Dude, I enjoy all the early episodes.
Mm-hmm. So the topic of our story today is a steamship called the Cazador.
It makes me think of tequila.
It means hunter.
That's why it has the big like stag on it, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're talking about the Cazador. This is not to be confused with the Spanish vessel that's typically referred to as El Cazador, mm-hmm. which sank in the Gulf of Mexico in 1784. That one was carrying a few hundred thousand newly minted Spanish coins. Mm. So who knows? Maybe we'll come back to that one at some point when the numismatic bug bites us. So this Cazador that we're talking about today was constructed in France in 1848. And purchased by the government of Chile in 1851. So around this time, the Chilean government found themselves in need of ships, as April of 1851 would see the opening shots of a revolution against the conservative government in an attempt to abolish the Constitution of 1833. So reviewing some of the things we discussed from the Angamos episode, we're dealing with the nation of Chile, which is made up almost entirely of coastline.
Yeah, that is an extremely coastal country, like, not by choice. It just is.
Yeah, so with Chile's, you know, very mountainous topography, maritime transportation, exceptionally important for the government to be able to move troops and personnel around the country. That was the intention that the Cazador was bought with.
I feel like in a, like a, you know, kind of a geography applied to politics kind of way, Chile has to be one of the most interesting countries in the world because it is, like, so...
Such an extreme of geography.
Yeah, like it's all ocean or mountain, and it's such a long, like, north and south run. Like, it's mm-hmm. it's interesting.
So by the end of the year, the uprising had been put down, with the conservative government of Manuel Montt retaining power in the country. His election had kind of been one of the sparks for this attempted revolution. So a little bit about Cazador herself. She displaced 250 tons and had a top speed of 9 knots. Everywhere I looked, I could not find any information about her other measurements. So that's all we've got. She did carry 3 guns, but it doesn't seem like combat was ever her intended use. Kind of just there so that she's nominally able to defend herself.
Right.
Her 3 masts were bark rigged. So this means that her 4 and main masts were square rigged with the mizzen mast rigged fore and aft, and she typically carried a crew of 65 to 70.
Okay, so she's not, like, a huge vessel.
No. She can carry a decent number of people, but she's not an enormous ship.
Do you recall offhand how big are we talking compared to the Angamos?
Her capacity is probably slightly larger.
Okay.
Because we're going to see, I think she has about 500 people on board. And I want to say the Angamos had something like 300 on board. 262 people were killed on the Angamos, with only 7 survivors. So yeah, we're talking about a vessel that at least has a higher capacity than the Angamos.
Okay.
So for the incident itself, today, one of the main sources is a set of notes submitted to the Chilean Congress the week after the incident.
Okay.
So a lot of that comes from firsthand accounts. We've talked about the advantages and disadvantages of firsthand reporting.
They're way more interesting, though. We know that.
Yeah, you get a lot of good detail. But again, this is especially if this is one person's perspective, there's things that people get wrong.
Right.
So Cazador arrived at the Chilean port of Talcahuano on January 26th, 1856. You'll hear a lot of the same place names that we talked about with Angamos. Talcahuano mm-hmm. was kind of the focal point for the rescue efforts. So on this voyage, she was captained by Ramon Cabieses. And from what I could find, he was the only captain she ever had in her career. Cabieses graduated from the Naval Academy in 1838, entering service as a lieutenant and getting almost immediate experience in the war against the Confederation of Peru and Bolivia. Mm-hmm. He was commanding the corvette Libertad. So due to his success in that conflict, he was promoted to captain on his return home.
At the time, is pretty much, if you're like a captain in working around Chile, like are these all Navy people? Like, are all these vessels Navy vessels?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, even we saw like Angamos, she was right. running basically civilian routes, but she was a military vessel.
And are we looking at the same thing in with this one, or are we talking purely like more like Birkenhead where it's military?
This one is more specific to the military because okay. she's gonna be carrying an actual unit of soldiers okay. and their associated personnel.
Gotcha.
So he also received a medal for his performance in the Battle of Casma in 1838. Through the 1840s, he continues in this service. And when the Cazador is brought into the Navy in 1851, Cabieses is put in command.
So he's clearly like highly thought of, respected.
Yeah, this is the first steamship that ever serves in the Chilean Navy. So you can imagine the Navy wanting that to go to a deserving individual, someone right. who's got some service under their belts. You know, they've proven themselves. So the vessel, you know, rather than the warships that he's been serving on before, this vessel is actually used for hydrographic work.
Okay.
So collecting the data to create and update navigational charts.
I feel like that'd be really boring to go from like war service to that.
Although I guess there is a lot of work to be done with the difficult coastline that Chile has.
That is true. You do want someone who knows what they're doing.
So when the Cazador arrived in Talcahuano on January 26th, her task was to load up with passengers for a voyage from Talcahuano to Valparaiso, a trip of about 260 miles north along the coast of Chile. Passengers were mostly soldiers of the 6th Company of the 2nd Regiment of the Chilean Army, who were being transferred to their new post in Valparaiso, accompanied by their families.
So this is kind of like a Birkenhead situation where it's mixed between.
This is essentially a dedicated military transport with a few people filling in the extra space.
Gotcha.
So the recorded number on board is 501.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a number established after the incident. There's a lot of gray areas here, a lot of stuff up in the air.
Right.
You see in some of the newspaper reporting after it, you see numbers like 300, but this number comes directly from the captain, and he has an itemized list of who all these people are, so it seems like a trustworthy number. He records 70 crew, 94 soldiers, 3 officers, these were Captain Don Valentin Rodriguez, and 2 second lieutenants. 280 women, 30 children, and 24 other passengers who weren't attached to a soldier.
Right.
Some of these are other, maybe civil government officials, people like that, with mm-hmm. their families. Any passenger and crew list from this time is going to be an estimate. We're looking at around 500 people on the trip. Okay. You've got to also account for, you know, sometimes children aren't recorded.
Stowaways. Like people, which is apparently a real problem at this time.
The usual suspects. So mm-hmm. we're dealing with somewhere around 500 people. So Cazador departed Talcahuano at 11:30 a.m. on the 30th of January. So she spent a few days loading up, getting ready to go, and she departs on the 30th. According to the ship's log, conditions were calm with a southerly wind as they began the journey north.
Sounds like a perfect day to be out on the water.
It does. Yeah, it's recorded as being a very nice sailing day.
Nice.
So due to the conditions, she's able to run her engines at half speed with her sails making up the rest, and making progress at about 8 knots. That was actually interesting to me because whenever we've talked about ships that have both capabilities, I've kind of always thought of it as an either or situation.
Me too.
But here it's kind of just taking advantage of, hey, we can run the engine a little bit less and let the sails
carry
some of that.
Because it's like a government thing where it's like, yeah,
maybe
we can save money. We need to.
So at about 6 p.m., Captain Cabiesas noted that they were about 5 or 6 miles off the coast. And he instructed the officer on watch to check the compass frequently and to make sure the helmsman was checking his course. After that, the captain retired to his cabin, as he would be taking the watch later that evening.
So he's like, but when he leaves, he's like, we need to be careful. Like, he's like, I guess just alerting everyone, like, how treacherous this is.
Full transparency. That is something that he said he did in his statement after the fact, when he's writing to the commander-in-chief of the Navy.
That does sound like something where, like, one of my kids breaks something, and then later on, like, I'm like, I told him not to do it. Like, well, really, I was sitting there laughing while it was happening.
And, like, it's totally, I mean, it's 100% believable, and I feel like it's not suspicious, but it is also kind of funny that he explicitly says, oh, yeah, and I told the helmsman to look out.
Yeah, this thing that happened, I said, no, do not let this happen.
You know, that's not recorded anywhere else but there. So those sailing conditions, they continued up until about 8 p.m., when, still at her cruising speed, she slammed into the rocks at Punta Carranza, 20 miles southwest of the city of Constitucion.
I feel like you're not supposed to slam into the rocks.
Ruins your day.
I guess it didn't matter how nice the weather was.
We actually saw that before, though, with, I want to say it was the Birkenhead.
Yeah, that the rocks would have actually been revealed.
It actually would have been better if the choppier seas had been there, because it would have exposed this rock. At this point, I used the measurement stick on Google Maps for this, but they're roughly a third of the way to their ultimate destination in Valparaiso. So upon impact, Captain Cabiesas ordered the engines into full reverse to free the ship from the rocks. However, the bow was seemingly stuck in there pretty good, because as the ship goes into reverse, the hull starts to come apart.
That's not good.
And this is recorded as happening lengthwise, so I think she's kind of like splitting down the middle.
That's what it sounds like. Like, that's gotta be a terrifying thing to see.
So this is obviously opening up her compartments to the sea. So, quoting here from the report of Captain Cabiesas, and anytime we quote from this, it's going to be in translation, translation done by me. So any awkwardness or inaccuracy is my fault.
At that time, with Lieutenant Roberto Segundo Simpson on watch, I was surprised by a violent jolt given by the ship as it struck Carranza rocks. I gave orders to get the ship somewhere close to shore to disembark, but these were ineffective. The hull had opened at the bow, and the whole disgraceful affair was reaching its end. Without another thought, I ordered, prepare the lifeboats, and everyone who was able to came on deck. There was no other means of salvation.
So this was a big maritime story. So this is also reported on in Lloyd's Weekly of London.
A fearful scene now ensued amongst those on board, including Englishmen and other Europeans. The gallant ship withstood some time the fury of the wind and waves, during which about 75 persons contrived to climb high up on the reef, when suddenly she broke in two, and sliding off the rocks, each half in opposite directions, 315 persons instantly perished. The total loss by this vessel, including the gold on board, is £250,000.
So they point out that Englishmen and Europeans are on board. So
that definitely like jumped to the front. That like look, even the good gentleman is in danger.
You should care about this.
It's funny they put that at the beginning so people will keep reading.
And like, it's Lloyd's, so like, I get that their focus is on like the financial side of things. But it's funny because that they have this kind of surprisingly detailed description of how this shipwreck is happening, and then the final line is the thing about it was worth this much money.
It is funny, like the whole Englishman thing. It's like, oh, someone you might know.
I mean, And it's like we do the same thing now, where it's like if a plane crashes in Kenya, you know, no one cares in the US unless there's an American on board, and then that's all over the news cycle. You know,
I mean, I feel like that's probably anywhere, right? Like, why would Sweden care about a plane crash in America unless there were Swedish people on it?
That's how it works.
It's just funny with it being like that bold of like Englishmen and other Europeans.
So in a very short time, she had flooded and sunk. So between the time of her running aground and her sinking, four of the ship's boats were able to be launched.
Okay. So she, do we get like a timeline or have any idea how long, like 20 minutes, 30 minutes?
We don't really have a good estimate. It's everything just says that it happens very quickly. So I've kind of taken that to be like somewhere between 5 and 15 minutes.
I suppose this could be a scenario where you're in luck that it's a naval vessel and that people are practicing lifeboat drills and are competent and capable, that maybe you can launch those pretty quick.
Yeah, from the captain's account, you know, it seems like he's in his cabin. He feels this. He runs to the wheelhouse, orders that, you know, full reverse, and this starts happening almost immediately. So I really don't think it was more than a few minutes.
Isn't it crazy how many of these stories through various different times, the captain's in his bunk?
It always works out that way.
Like, even when, like, it's not necessarily the captain's fault, like, I feel like he's in the bunk.
Well, yeah, in a case like this, it's like he's trying to do his due diligence. He's checking everything. He's telling the helmsman, hey, like, don't run into the rocks.
Mm-hmm. That quick side note here that reminded me of something. When I scroll TikTok now, get these TikTok lives, and it's like people operating heavy machinery. It's people like unloading and loading cargo containers, like, and they're not interacting with the camera. That's just there.
Yeah.
But I know at some point we're going to read one of these and it's going to be live streamed on TikTok. Yeah. And I don't care if it had anything to do with it or not. People are going to blame that as a distraction.
For sure.
And like, it's just, that has to be against company policy. Like, there's just no way.
I'm sure it is.
But it's interesting. I like watching it.
Yeah. So I was thinking about Michael Scott as the captain of this vessel. You ran into the rocks when I explicitly asked you not to?
It is kind of that, isn't it?
So back to our lifeboats here. Each of the lifeboats has a capacity of about 50. However, you know, the arithmetic of shipwrecks, as it often plays out,
I was about to say, I don't think there's enough room.
Well, that and, you know, 50 spaces on each of the four boats does not equal 200 people saved.
Right.
Two of the boats are very quickly smashed to pieces on the rocks.
That would be my main concern.
Two of them did successfully reach shore. Although in these two boats, there were only a total of 23 people. So each of those at much less than half capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Among those 23, as you might guess, because we've been reading his firsthand account, is Captain Ramon Cabieses.
Like, I'm a little surprised that he got on a lifeboat. I mean, I don't know how many competent people, like maybe an officer per boat or something like that. But you can't feel good about making it to shore because you know everyone's coming for you.
Right. And he writes a bit about that here. So by Cabieses' account, everyone who could get into a lifeboat had gotten into one before he jumped into the last one, as the ship was in its final moments.
I mean, that's what I would say as well.
Right.
Everyone who showed up got into the boats and made for the closest beach, which was not the safest route available. And upon approaching the shore, most had the misfortune of being lost. I got into the last boat that was lowered, which touched the water just as the ship was going under. And we directed the boat towards the cove at Constitution, where we arrived at 7 the following morning. Later, another boat arrived, under direction of the purser, with 13 men.
So as you've alluded to, this is, of course, going to bring the usual allegations of cowardice against the captain and the officers who did survive. Right.
Like, we've seen it in some of these stories of officers and captains getting a lot of blame when they, like, literally floated to shore with, like, a major hypothermia, missing fingers. Like, you know, if you show up in a lifeboat, people are going to be like, you got the last one, did you?
Yeah. And that aside, the fact that those 23 in the boats made it out alive may be a testament to the captain and the crew's abilities.
Mm-hmm.
So he writes about that in his account of it, but rather than make for the closest point on shore, those two boats that do make it, they first distance themselves from the wreck and they head out into the sea. So that's very likely saving lives that would have otherwise been lost on the rocks. If the captain is not in one of those boats,
right,
maybe you don't have anyone with the presence of mind to say, hey, don't just go for the closest spot on shore.
Mm-hmm. I think we talk about that kind of thing too. Like when we talked about the Titanic lifeboats and stuff, that like you do in fact need people that know what they're doing in these. Like it's not just women and children like rowing this thing themselves.
Right.
There has to be strong and capable people in these spots.
Yeah. And in this case, I mean, if you don't have crew in those boats, you probably have a single digit number of survivors in this wreck, just the people who happen to wash to shore.
Right.
Captain Cabieses, he went to the governor of Constitucion to inform him of the disaster and to urge for rescue to be sent to the location of the wreck. And that's another thing here is it kind of highlights the fact that why this sinking is so strange, because the captain clearly is keeping an eye out. He has an eye for where they are. Mm-hmm. You know, he immediately knows what rocks they've hit when they hit them, or he seems to at least. And when they get in the boats, he immediately knows where they need to go to get to a larger town where he can actually get help.
Yeah. Yeah. He seems very capable. I mean, clearly he knows what he's doing by the way he responds.
So on his way to address these issues through all the proper channels, he met with deputy, basically a congressman for Constitucion, Don Jose Ignacio Larraín. And he's actually able to sort of cut through some of that red tape and jump into action more quickly.
Without him, nothing would have been accomplished and time would have been lost in consultation and deliberation.
Through Larraín's efforts, preparations are made for the steamer Velos to head to the wreck site, and accommodations are made for the survivors of the sinking. Despite that enthusiasm, there's ultimately complications in obtaining the services of the Velos. I don't know what those are. Cabieses just refers to them as inconvenientes, inconveniences. So I don't know. I mean, it could just be a matter of it's not ready. Maybe it's under repair, something like that. So instead, it was resolved to travel over land back to the wreck site and attempt to provide what aid they could.
What aid could they reasonably provide at that point?
At this point, they're kind of just looking at throwing together whatever, you know, blankets and food and stuff they can get, and also just going and trying to pull people out of the water if they can.
So whoever like floats to the shore, basically.
Right. And at this point, of course, this is the following morning. By the time they get there, it's going to be, you know, late in the day. I doubt they hold out much hope of finding, you know, survivors, but they kind of feel obligated to do that. So in addition to those in the boats that made it to Constitucion, there were some survivors who made it to the shore from the water.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those managing to grab hold of floating boards and other debris, the usual things. Bringing the total number of survivors to 42 soldiers and sailors, in one female passenger.
Wow.
For a total of 43 survivors.
So this is, this is an interesting comparison to kind of the shipwreck data that we talked about, you know, like at this time that women and children did not fare well.
Yes. So doing that math, it gives us a death toll of somewhere just over 450, 458, you know, from those reports to Congress. Other estimates in writing about the wreck give it in the 300 to 400 range, although those probably are leaving out children and, again, unaccounted for stowaways.
Yeah, I think we talked about it quite a bit, that like, especially in this time, like children often just weren't counted as a passenger.
So among the dead were Talcahuano Customs Administrator Manuel Iñiguez, along with his wife Mercedes Vial and their daughter Olimpia, along with their niece and two servants. I looked into some of the names that were listed just to see what I could find about some of these people on board, and there wasn't a lot available for most of them, but this was one where I did find just a little bit. Iñiguez and his wife Mercedes, they had been married for 35 years.
Wow.
So we can add them to our list of tragic shipwreck couples.
You've just given me a great idea for next year's February bonus episode. We're doing Valentine's Day.
That's actually a really good idea.
Copyright TM.
Yeah, I like that idea. We could compile some of those stories. So the loss of the Cazador would be, and still is, the deadliest maritime incident in the history of Chile.
Definitely hope they don't set a new one.
Preferably not.
Yeah, I'm okay with that record standing.
So getting into some of the aftermath, closing segments here. So in his written statement to the Commander-in-Chief of the Navy, Cabieses summarized his knowledge of the causes for this wreck as follows.
I cannot conceive, sir, of the reason for the loss of the ship under my command that has taken place. I blame no one, nor could even the helmsman's deviation from our course induce me to assume that this was its only cause, unless some change of course given by me has caused it. The court-martial that judges me will examine the cause of this disgraceful event.
The language that he uses in his letter is fascinating,
mm-hmm.
because there's the air of like almost abject humility, and you can kind of see how that's kind of his only play probably yeah. right now.
Uh-huh.
He's writing this to like his boss's boss's boss, like the commander of the Navy.
He kind of understands, like, probably can't blame like the potentially dead guy. Kind of wear it a little bit.
Yeah, and even including that thing, you know, unless, you know, some change of course I gave caused it. So he keeps that that factor on the table too. It's like, hey, it could have been my fault. I don't know, we'll figure it out.
Probably like genuinely just happy to be alive after all that mm-hmm. too. And it's just like, sure, whatever. I don't care.
So he was court-martialed after the incident. He was found not guilty of any wrongdoing.
Mm-hmm.
And a thing to keep in mind, I think, that's important with this decision is Cabieses' previous service in the Chilean Navy. You know, he's one of their best guys. He's got a history. You know, he's a very well-respected member of the military. And the fact that his actions after the grounding, they probably did directly save lives.
Right.
So he has a lot of stuff falling in his favor, and in terms of evidence that he committed any sort of misconduct, there really isn't much.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, you know, this court-martial, you know, they're talking to the other survivors. Plenty of the crew survived, or, you know, not plenty, but enough of the crew survived the officers to know whether or not he had committed some error. And you'd think that would have come out in the court martial, right. So.
And I think it's also nice seeing him not get punished for the outcome. Like, it was a bad outcome. You know, no one wanted that. But when he was presented with that scenario, he did everything he could to minimize it.
So he would continue his government service in various positions, you know, after he's exonerated of blame for this. He'd reached the rank of major general, which, just from my reading, from what I understand, correlates more or less the same rank in the U.S. military, mm-hmm. Being in command of a division-sized force. This is kind of a sidebar, but I did find that this rank has since been replaced in the Chilean military.
Interesting.
With the rank of divisional general, after a 2002 change to the ranking nomenclature.
I guess that kind of makes sense. Like, you say, like, what he is the general of, he's the general of the division.
Yeah, and there was others. Like, this is, there's a website. It was like the Chilean law codes and stuff that I was reading. And along with this, they changed the position of Teniente General to General de Ejército, Army General, Mayor General to General de División, and Brigadier General to General de Brigada, which I guess makes sense because I don't know why these were made, but it seems like maybe just because they sound more natural in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Brigadier doesn't sound natural to me, I guess, in Spanish. So Cabieses also continued to conduct hydrographic work for the Navy, mapping several island areas in the country, including the Guaitecas Archipelago. You know, when you look at Chile on the map, mm-hmm. you get down into the southern part, and it's a yeah. mess. Like,
it's crazy.
There's a lot less mainland and a lot more islands of varying sizes and channels that, you know, all need to be mapped at some point. Definitely would take quite a bit of work to figure all that stuff out. And we can put a decent little bow on this, because Cavieses' career actually ends with a connection back to the Angamos.
Really?
Somewhat. As a refresher, the Angamos, episode 14, that was purchased by the government for use in the Chilean Civil War of 1891. That was a war that saw the government forces of José Manuel Balmaceda, with the support of the army, challenged by the Congresistas, with the support of the Navy. So you had that civil war divided along service lines, army versus Navy, basically.
We just play a football game here.
One of the leading figures in the Navy at that time was our boy, Ramón Cavieses.
Huh. Interesting.
You know, at that point, he would have been quite old, but also very experienced. So he was one of the kind of authority figures in the sort of ruling Navy junta. So yeah, interesting. He connects back to our first Chile story.
Yeah, that is really interesting.
Also, the history of Chile in the 1800s is just like civil war, revolution, revolution, civil war. It's a lot to get through. Another result of this. So due to the continued hazards to shipping in that area, including the 1892 wreck of the SS John Elder, a decision was made to install the Cabo Carranza lighthouse at this location. No lives were lost in the sinking of the Elder, but it did seem to kind of serve as the final straw. Several other ships had wrecked almost in this exact same area throughout the 19th century. So they decided we could use a lighthouse here. That lighthouse is still in service, being operated by Chilean Navy personnel and also serving as a meteorological station since the 70s. So I think that wraps the main story of the Cazador here.
Yeah, I'm looking at that lighthouse now, actually. It's
there was something special about it. I forget. I read it on, I think it was just the Wikipedia page. There was something unique about its structure, its base. It has like a square base and like octagonal tower.
It is the only Chilean lighthouse with a metallic pyramidal tower and a rectangle base.
Our lighthouse people will be interested in that.
Yeah, go lighthouse people.
There's a lot of cool lighthouses in Chile. That would be a cool trip, is a lighthouse tour of Chile, because there's a bunch of them.
Yeah, it does look really cool. It's such a desolate landscape. Like, I like it. I think it looks cool. But definitely not what you think of when you think of South America. I feel like we are a little skewed to think, like, you know, Brazil.
Beaches.
But there's so much more, and it's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's all. I mean, I had a few final thoughts, but I think we ended up covering those. I mean, this is a story. These are the stories to me that are kind of some of the scarier ones, because we're left without really good knowledge of why this happened.
Right. Other than like maybe someone didn't pay attention.
Yeah. It's like you kind of left with it. Well, you know, someone must have gotten distracted. But it's like, come on, it's 1856. Like, what distractions do you have? What are you doing here?
You're not scrolling Twitter, right? Yeah.
Come on. Got to pay attention here.
Yeah, no, I like these kind of stories. It's always fun to do the ones where there's not a lot of sources in English. Who knows? Maybe someone hears this story and decides that this is their life's work and they want to do even more.
Yeah, so that's that. We'll wrap this one up here and see if you've made it this far. Thank you for listening. And we will be back with another story next week.